This is Car Expert.
I guess for some people, the looks of it might be the real letdown because everything else is so good.
But then you drive one and you just feel like the absolute king of the world. It's such a primal part of your brain that it tickles.
As being Mazda's only all-electric vehicle in Australia, I don't know why you would bring a mild hybrid version.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner and a big hello to William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy.
And Scott Colley, hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Now, what's on your Christmas car list for this year, guys? Not obviously a full-on car, but I'm assuming, like, plenty of merchandise galore.
I'm a firm believer that car people like cars and not car merchandise. So short of a brand-new Cayman GT4 maybe, if you're listening, Santa, I'm very much of the belief that my clothing and my car should stay separate.
Like if I'm at a car show, for example, a Volkswagen show, I would go in a Volkswagen hat, a shirt, a hoodie, because I'm fitting in with everyone else. Everyone's wearing the exact same thing.
You've got your Beetle uniform on.
You had some interesting car merchandise for Christmas come across your desk this week, Scully.
I did. Actually, I was having dinner with my folks and it was mailed to my dad who has a Porsche Macan. And it's the Porsche Christmas catalogue for 2020. And it's beautiful. It's black with gold lettering and it all looks very expensive, which makes sense when you see what's inside. So I'm going to throw an item from each page at you guys and we're going to do this Price is Right style. Whoever gets the closest without going over wins a prize I'm yet to decide.
Hang on, let's cue the music.
Mandy Turner, Will Stopford, come on down.
All right, what's the first one?
All right, so first one is a GT4 Club Sport Collection baseball cap.
Ooh, I'm going to put in $50.
I'm going to put in $70.
I'm sorry, you're both out. It's $40.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. So it's a red, black, and white cap in the Porsche Motorsport colors with Porsche Motorsport across the front. Looks quite good, actually. There are more expensive options on the list, but this is just an entry-level cap.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's go the Women's Motorsport Replica Collection black polo shirt.
Now, women's shirt, I think they're usually a little bit cheaper than men's.
Really? I thought that'd be like a lady premium, like with haircuts.
Actually, you're probably right. I'm going to go maybe 70.
Oh, I'm going to go 90.
Yeah, Will Stopford takes this one. It's 125.
Oh, really? Oh,
but it does look to be a Hugo Boss polo shirt. And if it's not a Hugo Boss polo shirt, Porsche is sponsored by Hugo Boss and puts it on the breast of it regardless. So either good branding or good quality shirts, one of the two. All right, page three, we're into the baby section now.
Oh.
For a 917 Salzburg Collection child's polo shirt.
Oh.
For a baby that would grow out of it within months, no more than $30.
Like a baby, or are we talking like a toddler?
We're talking kid sizes 98 to 164, Australian 4 to 14. Couldn't tell you what that means.
Means nothing to me. Those are just words. I'm going to guess $60.
I'm sorry. I was distracted by the price. It's $80.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just grow out of it.
Yeah, you guys aren't great at this game, as it turns out.
Are there any non-clothing items that we might actually have an idea for?
There are. So we're now getting into the really juicy stuff, but the last clothing item I think you need to guess because it's called the Transaxle Collection, hashtag Porsche Collection Socks. They're unisex sizes 36/38 to 48/50. So for the small-footed or the big-footed person in your life, how much do you think four sets of socks in one pack will cost?
$60.
I was going to go 100, 25 a pair.
Will takes it, but only because it's closest without going over. $95, you were very close, Mandy.
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
I will say they are nice-looking socks. There's a sort of a tartan pattern on one. There's that classic checkerboard pattern from the seats. So you are going to have some of the best-equipped feet in the game. all right, getting on to the really interesting stuff. I'll speed this up now because I realize this podcast can't just be Who Wants to Be a Millionaire with Porsche and Price is Right. How much do you think it will cost you for two Porsche Crest espresso cups?
Oh, 70.
I was thinking 50.
Will Stopford on the money, $70.
Espresso cups. That is one branded item I would buy. Well, not espresso cups, but I love a good mug. Give me a mug with a logo on it, sure. But clothing, sometimes it can be really tacky. I'm sure Porsche stuff is a little nicer, but.
Okay, what do you think you will pay for a Heritage Collection Porsche Weekender bag? It's like a, I'd say it's about the size that you would take on a 2 or 3 day trip, and it looks really nice. It's sort of a classy cloth trim with beautiful leather straps and bronze buckles.
$1,200.
These are usually expensive. I probably wasn't thinking that much. I was thinking more like $850.
Mandy Turner takes it, $960.
Ooh.
Bargain.
Okay.
All right. Finally, this is our final showcase for fans of The Price is Right. What do you think you'll pay for a Porsche suitcase with a full car care kit inside?
Ooh.
And it's a special one, clearly, because it's called the White Edition.
Ooh, is the suitcase leather?
The suitcase looks like a fashionable Rimowa silver sort of jobby.
I'd say $2,000.
I'm actually going to guess less than you this time. I was going to say $1,500.
You've both gone bust. $1,490.
Oh.
Yeah.
$1,490.
Yes, correct. Not $14.90. That would be a bargain in the context of everything else.
Give me the link to the gift shop.
My other personal highlight is the Porsche 911 Bluetooth speaker, which looks like the exhaust from a GT3. $795 is getting into expensive territory for what is a pretty compact speaker, but it does look very, very cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for playing, guys, and come back next year.
All right, let's get stuck into the biggest car news of the week. And Scully, Toyota is ready for a RAV4-sized EV.
It sure is. So Toyota, as we know, has been one of the biggest proponents of hybrid power, especially in Australia where it dominates the hybrid space. But it's been a little bit slower getting into electric cars. Although it's got an electric CHR in China and it's got the UX300E, which is a Lexus, in some other markets, it'll be in Australia late next year. It hasn't really pushed into the space like some of the big premium manufacturers have, and now we're seeing obviously more mainstream brands like Volkswagen do it as well. But it has confirmed its first global electric vehicle. It's going to debut in Europe, which is where it's focused initially, will be a mid-size, so RAV4-sized electric car based on the new eTNGA platform. I'd love to tell you what sort of range it has, but we don't know. I'd love to tell you what sort of battery it has, but I don't know. And I'd love to tell you how many motors it'll have, but besides assuming top spec cars will have a dual motor all-wheel drive system, I don't know, because no one does except for the people in Toyota at the moment. They're keeping their cards very close to their chest. But
I feel like we need to play another game of The Price is Right. Let's do some guessing.
Yes, we can lock in our guesses now and check back in a couple of weeks when this is revealed. What we do know is eTNGA, which is the platform this car is built on, is pretty clever and very, very flexible. So it seems likely there'll be quite a few options. Not only can eTNGA do a number of different battery sizes, it can do single or dual motor, it can do different size wheelbases. Toyota's actually going to do 6 members of a single family on the car, ranging from what looks like quite a small city SUV all the way up to vans on it. It's also sold it to Subaru, or it's sharing the technology with Subaru as a part of its partnership, and Subaru is going to do the Evoltus SUV on it. So we know what's going on under the skin is going to be quite clever, and we know that given it's a midsize SUV, whatever Toyota ends up calling it, we'll go head-to-head with the Volkswagen ID4. But beyond that, if you've got any suggestions, send them to podcast@carexpert.com.au, I guess.
the sketches, that's not just a concept at the moment, isn't it?
So they're renderings of the range. There's been some leaks as well, but it's not quite clear whether the car that was leaked is the full-sized SUV that's a part of that 6 or whether it's the mid-sized SUV. Okay. It also isn't necessarily clear whether they're production versions or they're just concepts at the moment. So although they give us an idea about the design language that Toyota is going to have, and it's going to be pretty aggressive and very similar to its current cars in that it'll be quite angular, and I think some people will love, some people will hate it. But we don't know whether that full-on look is just for the concepts or the renders or whether that's actually going to translate to production on normal wheels with normal mirrors and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, they look a little bit concept-y, but, yeah, time will tell, obviously.
Exactly. Cross your fingers that they're handsome.
Yes.
I think the name Evoltus is very interesting because, to me, like all of these concepts, they look, obviously they look very concept-y, but they, you know, they look thoroughly modern and that. But I always find it funny when car companies kind of put themselves in a corner by giving names that can be so easily modified and used against them, because we heard so many people saying, you know, Holden Craptiva all of these years, and Evoltus, I mean, you just add an R and it's a very insulting name.
Sorry, Evoltrus?
Well, no.
Revoltus?
I don't follow. No, yes, Revoltus.
Yeah, you're right, actually. Yeah, let's hope we do not hear that word, though, and it'll be the car. Will, the Ram 15 is coming next year, but the top-of-the-line TRX still has not been confirmed for Australia yet, has it?
No. So there is a company that has announced that they are going to do a local conversion of the TRX. That company is called SCD American Vehicles. They're actually based in Brisbane, no less. So far, the factory-backed Ram Trucks Australia, which does the local re-engineering, as they call it, for right-hand drive, Ram Trucks Australia has not said yet that they are going to be bringing the TRX here. However, I would put money on them doing it because, holy crap, as they said, as a spokesperson from Atiko said, they see the value of a halo vehicle, and there's surely no better halo vehicle for the local Ram range than this 6.2-litre supercharged V8 off-road ready, absolute, like, I'm not even a huge pickup truck guy, but I just have to, like, give them credit for engineering this. It just blows the Raptor right out of the water. 520 kilowatts of power, 881 newton meters of torque. Those are some big figures there. And we've seen...
Why do you need something that powerful in a ute?
Why do you need anything? Honestly, why do you need a Ferrari? You're just going to be... unless you're going to track, what's the point? You know, and that's the thing. There's so many cars that celebrate excesses like this. I could see if you lived maybe out in the Sonora Desert or something and you wanted to run over some dunes on the weekends. I don't know. Maybe you run a Mexican cartel. I'm not sure. it's an impressive truck, but that's obviously, even if they do bring it here, that's not going to be their volume seller. Their volume seller is the regular 1500. So what they're actually going to do is keep the current 1500 running alongside the new 1500, which has already been on sale in the US for like over a year now. And so far they've announced that the new DT Series 1500, another name that could be used against them, will come here in limited trim, which is the absolute top spec model that's available in the US, in the very large model range that they have there. So we're talking heated and ventilated front and rear seats, leather, real wood trim, a 12-inch touchscreen system, touchscreen infotainment system, and you've got options like your semi-autonomous parking assist and your surround view camera. So it's clearly it's going to be positioned as a more premium alternative to the regular 1500. But it's a gorgeous looking pickup truck. Now they haven't officially announced what engines are going to be coming here. The 1500, the DT series 1500 range in the US is available with a 3.6-liter Pentastar V6, a 3-liter turbo diesel V6, and a naturally aspirated 5.7-liter V8 petrol engine. That's available both with and without Ram's e-torque 48-volt mild hybrid system. Now, currently, the DS series 1500 is available here with the Hemi V8, the 5.7-liter, and also the turbo diesel V6. So I would dare say that those are the engines that are going to be brought here for the new series. But yeah, nothing's been confirmed yet other than the fact that they will be bringing it here early next year. So it's very exciting. Look, I know a lot of these are trucks that generate a lot of I don't know what's a word for it, mate, like controversy. There's a lot of people who say, not even about the TRX, but about just like the 1500 itself, what do you need that for? Oh, a giant pickup truck, just like Americans. Like, why do you need such a giant vehicle? But for some people, they do serve a need. For other people, their need or want is just to look cool. Credit to FCA for actually bringing them here, because Ford hasn't bothered to bring a right-hand drive F-Series here for years. GM does through GMSV, the Silverado. But the Ram is especially the new DT series, is a very impressive-looking truck.
I do think it's very easy to hate these trucks because they sort of stand for everything that I think frustrates motoring enthusiasts. They're big, they're heavy, they're thirsty, and to be honest, they do a job that most people could probably do with a small Volkswagen Caddy van or a hatchback if they're just driven around the city. But then you drive one and you just feel like the absolute king of the world. It's such a primal part of your brain that it tickles. But I jumped in the Ram 1500 a couple of years ago, and I live in kind of inner city-ish Melbourne. So I couldn't park it in my garage. It was sort of parked across two spots on a side street nearby. It, you know, people look at you sideways, but you drive it and you sit higher than everything else. You've got that V8 rumble. You just feel like an absolute king or queen or whatever royalty you want to associate with. It's just so much fun. And I'm really excited to see if that TRX does come to Australia, how the first Hilux Rogue driver you pull up to at a set of lights will react, because all of a sudden, those cars that were the biggest, toughest, meanest-looking things on the road are kind of dwarfed by these Rams.
Was it? I think it might have been advertising Ram not long ago in Australia, where I think the slogan was "Eats Utes for Breakfast."
Yeah. Correct, that's their slogan. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Very, very true.
Exactly, and it's also important to look at the historical context with how American pickup trucks have gotten to be like this, because if you go back to say the 70s or so. Pickup trucks were seen as basic workhorses. You were driving it for a purpose, but then, you know, the big three started adding more luxury features there. And I think what happened is, as people in the US shifted away from the big traditional kind of body-on-frame passenger cars, as those started disappearing from the market, they saw the opportunity to, instead of having one really kind of big floaty sedan and one really rough riding pickup truck, they could have a vehicle that they could actually drive to church on the weekend or whatever, but could also be used for work. So they're not just show ponies, they are workhorses as well. So it'll be very interesting to see this new DT series.
Absolutely. Now, moving on to a completely different segment of cars now. Scully, this is actually really cool. Nismo are fully restoring old Nissan R32 GTRs, but it comes with a pretty penny.
It sure does. So, as is often the case with really beautiful heritage cars, the number of them on the roads is shrinking, and it's getting harder and harder to look after them, because obviously you're reliant on parts that aren't in production anymore and that aren't going to be made ever again because cars have changed so much. So rather than letting Nismo or, you know, Nissan GTR owners with a lot of money in their back pocket go to external tuner shops to get their cars fixed, Nismo has decided that it's going to do full restorations, and I really mean full restorations. Every nut and bolt new, chassis checked, strengthened, counterbalanced, and like electro-dipped to stop it getting rusted. Full ground-up restorations of the R32 GTR. It's not going to come cheap. Depending on the exchange rate, this number changes, but it's going to cost you about $430,000 US. So we've just called it upwards of $500,000 Australian because it will change based on the exchange rate. But it's really not cheap to get this done. Nismo will also source you a car if you really want, which will obviously add more to that again. But yeah, the attention to detail in this program is just incredible. So anything from stripping bare the chassis, evaluating it, fixing and replacing any fatigued parts, and then sealing the body, to retrimming the interior, either cleaning it thoroughly and then retrimming it with the original materials, or if you're a little bit tired of the upholstery, completely redoing it in the modern materials from an R35 GTR. They will take out all the sound deadening. They will put every new nut and bolt in there, and they will even then put it on the dyno, check it, give it a little Nismo tune if you've got a bit more cash to spend, and send it out for a shakedown with a professional test driver afterwards to make sure it's in good nick, and then present you back your car with a 20,000 kilometer warranty and a book showing everything that's been done to it. It's obviously not for everyone with a price like that. But I do think it's really cool to see factories, I think, recognizing the heritage and the significance of these cars to enthusiasts. And the R32 GTR, as anyone listening to this podcast will know, is such an important car for enthusiasts in both motorsport and just in the world of enthusiasts on the road. A friend of mine actually has one, and I've been lucky enough to have a drive, and it's so cool, and it's such a unique experience compared to a modern car. So the idea of more of these hopefully getting around on the roads, if not getting around on the roads, being presented very nicely in hermetically sealed garages for people to look at is going to be a good thing, if you ask me. But yeah, if you do get this done, please drive your car, and then please let me drive it, actually.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you spend that sort of money, I would be literally afraid to take it anywhere. Around the corner. But do you know what sort of prices the normal R32 GTR is fetching these days in unrestored condition?
It depends on what sort of R32 you go for, because obviously there's different model years, and also in Australia there's originally delivered cars, which are pretty tough to come by. And then there's also imported cars from Japan, which are a little bit easier to track down, but obviously aren't worth quite as much because they've got to be brought over on a boat and you don't know what's been done to them. So
the cheapest one for sale at the moment is $65,000, and the most expensive R32 GTR is $135,000.
Right. So we're talking some pretty serious money to start with.
Yeah.
But like, even like for 65 grand and you could spend another 500,000, I can't get my head around this.
I find it really hard to understand as well, to be honest, because I think part of the charm of these old cars is that they have a bit of character about them. You know, they're not perfect to drive nor to look at, but they've lived a life, and that's part of the reason that they're really appealing. So, yeah, it's so cool. The idea of a brand new R32 GTR in 2020 is so cool. But it does also pull away a bit of the romance from owning an old car and running it and getting to know its quirks, which, Mandy, as a dedicated classic car owner, you would understand better than most.
Mm. Couldn't agree more. Now we're going to move on to a brand new model that's coming to Australia. The Mazda MX-30, Mazda's first EV, is coming, Scully.
It is. So Mike Costello went last week to Mazda to learn all about the MX-30. And Mazda's been talking about this car for quite a while. It was released at last year's Tokyo Motor Show, and the big question was, will it come to Australia? And the answer was, maybe. and Mazda's been pushing us back and pushing us back, but they've finally confirmed we're going to get the fully electric version, and we're also going to get a hybrid version, which isn't the range extender, because the range extender hasn't been revealed yet. That's going to have a rotary engine that'll act as a generator for the battery, but it's going to be like a mild hybrid version with a petrol engine. I believe it's got claimed fuel economy of about 6.5 litres per 100 Ks, so it's not the most efficient thing in the world, but it does look quite cool. But the big news is the electric car, and it's got a 35.5 kilowatt hour battery. It's got 107 kilowatts of power, 271 newton meters of torque, and it'll do about 200 kilometers on a single charge based on the WLTP test cycle, which in the context of cars like the Hyundai Kona Electric and the Tesla Model 3 isn't all that much. But in the context of most people driving not all that far to work and then not all that far home, I think about 30 Ks is the average commute according to Australian census data. 200 kilometres is a week of commuting. It does seem like Mazda has very much targeted the same sort of people that might have once bought a BMW i3 with this car. It looks quite quirky. It's got suicide doors, so the front door has to be open for the back door to open. You can have it with a contrasting roof and all sorts of other bits and pieces that make it a really interesting flagship for Mazda. What I also find interesting, though, is the fact that Mazda actually expects the hybrid, which is going to be here in the first half of 2021, and then the electric car will be here in the middle of next year. The hybrid's actually expected to be the better seller. So along with the fact that it's an electric car and, you know, a tech leader for the brand, I think Mazda's banking on this car being a bit of a flagship for it as a part of its premium push. It's got some really interesting interior materials. It's a little bit different to look at to any of its other cars. And because of that, I think the hybrid is going to be quite a fashionable sort of city SUV that even if you don't buy the fully electric car, you can still buy into Mazda's more premium push and show what the brand can do.
What price do we reckon the maybe the hybrid could end up being once it's here?
So the CX-30, which is a similar size but is a more conventional car, you can pay up to very close to $50,000 for that with the Skyactiv X mild hybrid engine. I would be surprised if the MX-30 was any cheaper than that car, purely because they're a similar size, but the MX-30 is the more fashionable car with the more sophisticated drivetrain. I think around $45,000 or $50,000, and that is purely just speculation, is where I would have it pegged. But I'm also open to being contradicted or told I'm wrong, Will.
No, I was just going to say that this is a car that has had me scratching my head from day one. I love the way it looks. I think it looks great. The interior looks nice too. Mazda's finally introducing an electric car. Yay for them. What confused me when it was first revealed was that they would call it MX-30, suggesting it's like part of the same kind of family, if you will, as vehicles like the MX-5, the old MX-6, etc. But okay, I get it. It's a coupe SUV. It's even got the coupe doors. All right, fine. And then they announced that they were introducing a mild hybrid version in Japan. And I thought, oh, well, just for Japan. Okay, a little strange, but all right, that makes sense for them, I guess. And then they announced that they're bringing it here. And I mean, look, I don't want to ever tell a car company, don't bring multiple options here, because variety is the spice of life and all that. But you're introducing a vehicle that's going to be almost kind of like a hero vehicle for the a halo vehicle for the brand, sorry, in a way. And people will be like, oh, that's that new Mazda electric car. And then you will say, oh, no, I don't have the electric one. I've got the mild hybrid. Oh, hybrid. It must get really good fuel economy. Oh, yeah, I get about 6.5 litres per 100 kilometres. And then the person in their Yaris hybrid just kind of shakes their head and furrows their brow. It's a little puzzling because you've got the power of it as a halo vehicle as being Mazda's only all-electric vehicle in Australia. I don't know why you would bring a mild hybrid version. Maybe if it was a regular hybrid with really good fuel economy or a plug-in hybrid like Hyundai does with its Ioniq offering the hybrid plug-in and electric versions. Sure, I get that, but I'm very perplexed by this. I think the mild hybrid probably will outsell the electric version, but that's only because electric vehicle sales are so, virtually statistically insignificant here, and because the mild hybrid will likely be, cheaper to some degree than the electric version. So,
I think the logic of that, I sort of see what you're saying, but I think the counterpoint to that is you walk into the showroom and you love the look of the MX-30 and they go, oh, it's electric only. You walk out and go, well, I don't want an electric car necessarily, but I really love the look of it. And I think we've seen with the BMW i3, for example, a lot of people are intrigued by it but can't necessarily get on board with the range extender or the electric powertrain because it's still too foreign to them. So for Mazda, as a flagship and as a car to get people talking about your brand, to get it looking sharp on the road, I kind of understand the logic of having the hybrid there as the car that you can go, look, the flagship one, it's a bit more expensive, it's fully electric, it's really cool, but we understand if that doesn't work for you and you have to park on the street, how about you still look really cool, but you fill up at a petrol station instead? I can see how that works in the world of flagship cars where, I do think it is a car where some people are just going to see it and go, I just have to have one of those. I really love the way it looks. And having that option makes a lot of sense in my head.
I know that you love the Louis Vuitton handbag, but you can't afford the Louis Vuitton handbag. But
you leave my Louis Vuitton out of this, Will.
You can get this Louis Vuitton handbag. It's not actually made by Louis Vuitton, but, it's a little bit cheaper. So you can still look like you have a Louis Vuitton, but you actually don't.
Exactly, yeah. And I think for Mazda, which, clearly is trying to be a little more premium, its pricing's more expensive and its cars are beautifully put together, especially at the top end. Having that flagship and trying to attract the type of buyer that it seems like it wants to, it's going to be a real win for them because stylish young people who, have a bit of cash to burn because they've got no kids can stroll in off the street and say, I really love the look of that, I'd like one. And rather than being turned away because they don't have a garage to charge it in, they can still walk away with their Mazda that is a good ad for the brand and makes them feel good about themselves, which I realize sounds like a lot of marketing speak. I don't know what I've become.
We should have used the term stylish young tastemakers.
Oh, yes. Thought leaders.
Active singles.
That's now sounding like a dating ad.
Let's end it there, shall we?
There are three Mazda MX-30 owners in your area.
Find people open to suicide doors nearby.
Click the car news link at carexpert.com.au.
This week's completely off the rail.
Hello to you, James Wong.
Hi there, Mandy, and hello, boys. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You've just come back from the launch of the new BMW 4 Series. Yes. Let's get it out of the way first. First impressions on its looks.
Oh, well, that's a bit of a long story, isn't it?
Because obviously, photos we've seen on the site would look different than seeing it in person, right?
Yeah, I think this has been very discussed in detail over the past few months, but I was one of the people that really panned the new design. I was a bit disappointed that they decided to go so just out there when the previous 4 Series was the previous 4 Series was one of the nicest BMW designs ever. Like, it's so clean, it's well proportioned, it's attractive, and it aged really well, particularly that that midlife refresh with all the nice lights and everything. I think it was one of just their better designs. And then I sort of was a bit disappointed that they went from having one of their most attractive vehicles in the range to having one of the ugliest ones, at least in photos. But in saying that, now that I've gone to the launch, I've driven it and been able to actually have a look at one in detail with several different colors, different specifications in terms of wheels and packages and all that kind of stuff. I've really warmed to the look. It's much more resolved in person, I think, because everything, when you get the depth perception of seeing it in the flesh and sort of seeing how the creases work and how the body plays with light, it is much nicer than you might expect. So I was pleasantly surprised. I know some people still don't feel that way, but it's definitely not as bad as what I initially thought. I still think they should have made it closer looking to a 3 Series, but, you know, it's not my decision.
That was actually going to be one of my questions. BMW made the 4 Series badge because it wanted that car to be different to the 3 Series. And I know the last 4 Series was pretty, but it was also definitely pretty closely related to the 3.
Yeah.
Is this more different in person than the last car was to the 3 Series?
Oh, absolutely. And it actually really comes out in the driving character as well, which I'm sure we can get on to in a little bit. But we spoke to one of the lead designers on a media call, and he was talking about how they've really tried with this generation, despite the shared underpinnings and obvious carryover stuff inside, that they really wanted to give the 4 Series its own personality, and they're going to start doing that more and more with all of the coupe models in their lineup. So you probably be prepared to see more like variations of the design, and you won't just see, for example, like a 3 Series front with a 4 Series rear, which was almost sort of like what they've done previously, or, you know, vice versa with some of the X models. So and I think what they're trying to do is sort of appeal to those people who want something that just looks different. Now, whether different is attractive or not might be another thing to you, but I think they're really trying to differentiate it, and it really comes out in the exterior design, obviously, and then in the way it drives as well.
So what has BMW actually done under the skin to differentiate it? Are we talking like just suspension tweaks, or does it actually have some fundamental changes?
There actually are some real fundamental changes. So it's got wider front and rear tracks compared to the 3 Series, and it's also got a longer wheelbase. So, you know, you look at it dimensionally, and it's got a much larger footprint, and, you know, it's probably a bigger car physically when you look at length and width. So it certainly stands a little bit different. And when you're driving it, I remember one of my first experiences with a 3 Series was a 330i sedan with M Sport package. Beautiful thing. It was in that beautiful M Sport blue and, you know, well-specced and everything. But one of my biggest issues with it was that it was just far too firm in everyday driving, even on the freeway. EastLink in Melbourne is quite a smooth stretch of road, which I'm sure Mandy and Scott can attest to. And I was going down at one point, and I was just bobbing around so much that my neck was sore from driving, because I was like trying to keep my head straight. And I think I just yelled out in frustration once, because I was just like, can this thing just freaking keep me still? Because it was just, even in comfort, it was just too much. But I think the way that what they've done with the 4 Series is that they've widened and lengthened you know, the footprint of the car. So it's a lot more resolved in terms of ride, but it still has, it almost has better road holding and more grip because there's just more, it's got a bigger, you know, grip patch on the road. And it just, it's much better resolved in every way to a 3 Series. And especially when you think that it's a, you know, a sportier car with, it's also got, you know, firmer spring damper rates and all that other stuff. I don't know all the figures off the top of my head, but it's obviously got a more focused mechanical set. But it didn't, I was surprised at how livable it was to use, especially because we were driving, you know, out in Melbourne's outer east into like the hills, and there's a lot of country roads out there. There's potholes, there's patches of gravel and things like that. I really could not upset this car with any of that stuff. It's just so, it's hard to explain other than say it just does everything so well, and it's almost clinical with just how good it was in every aspect. And so I guess for some people, the looks of it might be the real letdown, because everything else is so good. The interior is plush, and especially compared to most of its competitive set now, a lot of those cars are old, or, you know, in about halfway through their life. You think of, you know, Audi A5 just got a facelift, C-Class Coupe just got a facelift. The Lexus RC is getting on quite a bit, even though it keeps getting updates, but it's an old heavy platform with old engines. So this 4 Series has sort of, it was already a very competitive car in that segment, but, you know, the previous one was a little bit firm, maybe a little bit noisy with run flat tires and everything. But this new generation, if you exclude the design from the equation, if that's something that really bothers you, it's sort of catapulted itself to the top of that class, and it's really widened the gap, because it's got everything that's been good about all of BMW's new product. Like the 3 Series is already a great car with some drawbacks like the ride and whatever, but this addresses all those, you know, mechanical or, you know, drivability issues in terms of the ride and whatever. But it also is just better in every way. And I think that it's just a really, really good bit of kit. So, It's still priced competitively. It's got a good amount of standard equipment, though we would like to see some of the tech that's standard on the mid-spec 430 to be set on the base model, because you're already spending, you know, high 70s for that car. But it's sort of got everything. And I was actually surprised with how which one was my favorite. I didn't actually get to try the 420, but to be honest, I don't think that would be my favorite, because it's the lower powered one and it doesn't have as much stuff in it. But between the 430 and the M440i xDrive, I was really expecting to fall in love with the 40, because, you know, all of the M performance models of late with the 40 badge, they have a really nice exhaust note, they go really fast, but unlike a proper M car, they're very usable as a day-to-day vehicle, whereas, you know, M cars are just far too firm and all that nonsense, because they're basically built for the track. But what I found was that the 430 was just a really good balance of all the good aspects, you know, all the aspects of daily driving, because it's about 200 kilograms lighter than a 440. So in the like really twisty bits, it just felt more like a pure sports car, but it was still fast enough and had a good exhaust note to sort of compensate for the lack of the 6-cylinder under the bonnet. It was just fantastic.
Can I ask about performance? How does that feel, and what were the driving modes like?
The performance is pretty good from both, like the two that I drove, the 430 and the 440. The 440 is obviously like, it's a very effortless sort of rocket ship thing, if that makes any sense. It sort of just goes, and you look down and you see the speed and you're like, oh crap, like I've got to slow down, because it's just so linear and it just shoots off the line with that all-wheel drive system. It's got so much grip. Like BMW claims a 4.5 second 0 to 100, which, you know, not long ago that was what the M4 was doing, and you'd be lucky to get that in an M4 with rear-wheel drive, because you just couldn't get the grip down. So this is just, it's just such a, you know, point and shoot sort of vehicle. And between drive modes, I was actually surprised that even though in Sport or Sport Plus, it really firms up in both the 430 and the 440, it was never uncomfortable. And we were driving on some pretty, you know, average road surfaces out like Gembrook Way. So that's sort of outer east, you know, through the Dandenongs and all that kind of stuff out in Melbourne's east. And it was never uncomfortable in any of the modes. And the 440 sounds great because it's got that beautiful inline six engine note, which really sort of has a trumpety tone to it when you get into the high revs. But unlike some of the other M40i models in the range, it doesn't have that like crack in the exhaust or that raucous overrun feature in the more aggressive modes that you might get in the other cars. I think that's down to emission stuff. So they're being forced to pull back a little bit on those things just to save fuel and emissions and all that nonsense. But the 430i, like it was, I felt that that was just the sweet spot because you kind of got that nice rear wheel drive chassis and it still had plenty of grip. So you didn't really feel like you needed the all wheel drive. We were driving on a hot day. So maybe that's a difference in the rain. It might be different, but it was so just, it had plenty of performance. It can do 0-100 and still under 6 seconds, which is faster than most hot hatches and as fast as anyone's really going to need to go in Australia because we don't have autobahns or anything like that. And when you really sink your boot into it, it really goes. Like the two engines that I tried have more than enough of performance for most people. And the driving modes offer a good degree of flexibility. One new feature with the 4 Series, and I think this will be rolled out to some of the other BMWs with that latest operating system, is you know how they have that voice assistant where you go like, hey BMW, now you can actually ask it to change the driving mode for you so that you don't have to go down and like look for the button, because that's something that's
brilliant.
So that way you're not searching for the button on the center console, which I know plenty of us have done in the past when you find a nice road and you're like, oh, I've better put into sport. And then if you're not, for people like us who are in and out of different cars all the time, sometimes you're like, oh, where are the buttons for this thing? And then by that point, you've already hit the first corner. So you're like, oh, okay, better, you know, keep my eyes on the road now. But yeah, so there's a few features like that, which are really cool. And yeah, as a sports car, I think that it's a good little thing, but it's also very comfortable as a daily. I personally think the 430 was a more like a purer or more enthusiast sort of experience because it's lighter. It feels a little bit sharper because it's not as heavy, but it still had plenty of go. So yeah, I was really impressed.
So it sounds like you prefer the way the 4 drives to the 3. So do you think when they release the 4 Series Grand Coupe that somebody who wants a little bit of extra practicality, who wants 4 doors, do you think the 4 Series Grand Coupe would be worth whatever premium it commands?
That's a really good question, and I haven't really thought about it that way. I think what BMW's got now is that there's going to be a car for everyone in that end of the market. A lot of, you know, this 3 Series is lighting the sales charts on fire at the moment. It's consistently one of the best-selling models in that segment. So I don't know if having a 4 Series Grand Coupe will hurt the 3 Series that much, but I think offering that option, it also depends on what they do with the dimensions, like whether they'll still adjust the wheelbase and the tracks anymore to accommodate that larger body, because the 4 Series Grand Coupe is a 5-door. And so typically they're a bit longer than the sedan. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with it. But if it drives anything like the coupe, which I'm assuming it will, I think that it would certainly be my pick if I didn't have to look at it. So, you know, if you don't really carry around people in the back and you sort of want that coupe looks, but you've got kids or something, I think that will certainly be a really appealing option for a lot of people. I think really the only barrier that the 4 Series has to people in that segment or that end of the market is just the looks are going to polarize regardless. Even though I like it, I know that looks are subjective. So I would, if anyone's looking at one or thinking about one, it'd be good to go have a look yourself and go through all the personalization options, because, you know, you can black out the grill or you can do a number of things, change the alloy wheels. It might look better in a different color. So I think it's really just down to personal preference and whether you like the design.
I thought you were going to say there, if someone's looking at one, I'm very sorry and maybe you should look in the other direction.
Don't look directly at the BMW.
I was actually speccing one on their online configurator earlier, and noticed that the standard 4 Series, not the M4, because the M4 was presented in that beautiful green color. You can get like a dark metallic green in the normal 4 Series, which I think was the hero color for the convertible press images. That looked nice. And I think it sort of goes well with all the dark bits if you option those packages. But yeah, it just really depends. Like the M440 gets that cerium gray stuff, which is almost like a bronzy finish on the grill and the wheels, which again is an acquired taste, or you can go for a more understated vibe. It just really depends. And I think that it can really change the character of the car, which is probably true for a lot of those luxury cars when you have black packs and aluminium packs and, you know, these some bright colors, some not. You can get metallics, you can get matte paints, you can get all sorts of things. So I guess it's really a matter of, this car may not look great in whatever hero images they sent out, but I think if you go in there and have a look, you might be pleasantly surprised like I was. But then beyond that, just the car itself, fundamentally, it's really good, really impressive. I was very impressed and surprised with just how good it was.
I know I wrote that op-ed recently criticizing BMW's design language, but there's a lot of BMW products now that I really love the look of. I love the look of the X7. And when I saw those initial photos of the new M3 and M4, I was down for that. But this 4 Series, I really need to see it in person, as you said, because I'm just not digging it. And what's funny is by putting all of this focus on this ginormous grille, BMW's actually just quietly gotten rid of the Hofmeister kink in the belt line, which is something they've, been putting on basically all of their cars for decades now, but not this 4 Series, which is a very, very interesting change to make.
Joe, I don't think we've spoken too much about the interior. How did you find the quality and the feel and the looks of it?
Again, really good. I think I touched on it briefly before, but, it's very standard new BMW in there. If you have sat in a 3 Series or an X5 or any of those new products, you're not going to be surprised with the layout or the design. The quality is top-notch. There's plenty of soft-touch materials. You can get the dash and doors lined in leather. You can get the interior in several different colors. There's an array of trim finishes. One of my favorites from the launch, there was one of the cars had this like aluminium weave. So it kind of looks like that carbon fiber weave that you can get, but it's an aluminium one. So it's got like a gloss lacquer over it with this beautiful weave underneath, which looks really nice. And then you can also option like an Alcantara insert, or you can get leather. It's all very nice, but it's all very standard BMW. Compared to the outside, the inside's very tame. So it's a very split personality. If you were blindfolded and put in one, you'd probably go, oh, this looks great, it's well finished, oh, it's got the coupe look. And then you'd probably get outside and be like, not sure. But yeah, the interior is great. One small gripe of mine with the current crop of BMW interiors is that I find that the digital instrument cluster, because I'm a bit of a tech nerd with car stuff, but the digital instrument cluster, I think, could use a little bit of work. It's very sort of fixed in the layout, and I am not particularly a fan of the weird hexagonal that's not even symmetrical dials that they have, and the lack of customization that you can have in the displays. I think Audi and Mercedes have been doing a really great job with their digital driver's displays in terms of offering customers the ability to, cycle between 3 or 4 different views or skins, and being able to have a map in a proper map in the middle that you can individually zoom in and out of using the steering wheel control, or you can have your trip computer and all that other stuff. I just think that the BMW one lacks a little bit of customization given the real estate available. And I know that with the previous generation of BMW products, they sort of still went for that conventional dial look, but it was in actual, they had like a physical ring and sort of filled in the gaps, and it just looked a lot cleaner. Whereas this one, they've almost tried to do a new age look, but they haven't given you new age levels of customization, which I think is maybe a little bit of a miss. But there's not much to complain about. It's ergonomically very good. The materials are great, especially compared to some rivals in the class. Like, I just stepped out of that Giulia a couple of weeks ago, which I sort of was a bit hard on it for the interior presentation. Not in terms that it's like badly made, but there's just some material choices that I just don't think work for a car that's that expensive. This is probably the benchmark in terms of material quality, because I think the Mercedes design is getting a bit old, and the C-Class doesn't even get MBUX like the GLC does, which is a bit of a weird thing. But and the Lexus is looking old. The new A5 looks nice, but I still think that the only real change they've made is updated the infotainment interface in terms of the look, and then tacked on a big screen. And while Audi interiors are well made, it can be a little bit austere and not that inspiring, whereas this really does feel, look and feel luxurious, and across all models too. Like the base one, even if you don't get like the extended upholstery package, still looks really nice. And then you step up to the top model that has like the leather stitch dashboard and everything, and it's just really, really premium. So it's a very nice place to sit. The seat's comfortable. The steering wheel, I love the chunky M steering wheels that BMW does. I think they're great to hold and they make you feel like you're driving something really sporty and special. The insulation over coarse chip roads, despite all of the cars we had were on 19-inch wheels and run flat tires, was excellent, which is something that hasn't always been a praise point for BMWs of old. So it does everything very well. It's a great all-rounder. It's very comfortable, very quiet. But then when you want to turn it up to 11, you can really have a good punt in one and enjoy yourself. So, I really don't have, as you've probably gathered, I don't have much negative to say about it because it's just a really, really good car all round. Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, that review now is up at carexpert.com.au. Check it out and let us know what you think in the comments below the story. James Wong, it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Great talking to you all too. Thank you.
And there goes this week's podcast. What cars are in the garage next week, Will?
Okay, so in Melbourne, we have got a Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross Aspire. So that's the updated Eclipse Cross. We've got a Mazda CX-5, a Kia Seltos Sport Plus with the turbocharged 1.6-litre. We've actually got quite a bit going on in Melbourne, a Ford Mustang GT, which I'm very jealous of. We've got an Audi Q3 35 TFSI. There's a Golf GTI TCR, a Jeep Compass Trailhawk, a Toyota Fortuna Crusade, and perhaps most excitingly, the all-new Land Rover Defender in P400 spec, which is very exciting. In Sydney, for once, they're not kind of bombarded with cars. There's only one in the calendar for Sydney next week, which is the Lexus UX 200.
Giving car off a break.
Yeah, exactly. Poor old sausage. Here in Brisbane, Bors is behind the wheel of an Audi Q750 TDI, and I will be behind the wheel of the updated Kia Stinger, which is exciting because it's actually my birthday next week. So it'll be nice to have a cool car for my birthday.
Nice birthday car for you. Lovely. Plenty of events happening next week also, Scully?
There is a bit going on. So this week we actually have, for the first time since we were founded, the entire Car Expert team in one room, which is really, really exciting. I know that that's not an industry event, but having started in March, we're all going to be sitting down together tomorrow, actually, as part of a sort of our editorial offsite. And I think that's the biggest event of the week this week because I can't wait to actually see everyone face to face. But next week, Hyundai is launching the Palisade and Santa Fe in Sydney. I'll be heading along to that to drive Hyundai's two biggest and best SUVs, which is very exciting. Volkswagen is launching the T-Roc 110 TSI style in Sydney as well. I think Tony Crawford or Kurt Dupre is going to be behind the wheel of that one. And then Mini is launching its JCW and James Wong will be going along to drive that. So there's a little bit happening coming into Christmas as everyone goes, oh, we still need to get these cars launched. that's about the end of it this week.
Yeah, nice. You've been driving a very nice car this week. Perfect weather to have the top down in a Lexus LC500.
I have. I love the Lexus LC500 Coupe. It was one of my favorite cars when I first drove it a couple of years ago. And it turns out lopping the top off does nothing but make it better. It still sounds absolutely incredible with that V8 engine. It looks gorgeous. It's just the sort of car that people want to come and check out, which I think is kind of cool. And it's the sort of car that, like, when I first picked it up from Paul on Friday, I drove it to my girlfriend's place and she lives on quite a tight side street. I was crawling along there and this kid in a shop on the side street ran out to the side and goes, "Rev it, rev it, rev it." And so of course I did, because it's exactly what I would have wanted when I was about 7. And the kid was just grinning and he ran back inside covering his ears. And I know that sounds like a made up story. I promise you it's not. But it's just the sort of car that gets people excited and makes them want to talk about cars, which is really, really cool. And the fact it's come from Lexus, which is the most sensible of sensible car brands, is even more remarkable.
Luckily, it wasn't a hybrid.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they didn't do a hybrid version of the convertible. I think they've decided that drop top people want to hear it. So,
yeah, good move.
V8 only.
And I'll tell you what, the V8 sounds a lot better than the hybrid. And I think this is one of the rare instances where it's not actually worse to get the convertible. Like, it doesn't look noticeably worse to get the convertible, and you've said it drives really well as well, so...
It doesn't drive quite as well as the coupe, I don't think. Occasionally, it's a little bit wobblier, but I say that and it really is minute amounts on, you know, what was already a really nice car to drive. And yeah, the whole point of that Lexus is to be seen and to make noise, and why not do that with the roof down?
And it looks a lot better than an SC430. Let's not forget that. A lot.
That's a very good point. It is one of the best looking cars I've seen this year, as opposed to the SC430, which is, yeah.
Let's not go there.
I think let's not go there.
Okay. All right. William Stopford and Scott Colley, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.